Hi, Steve.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Not too bad.
Okay, that's funny. That's the way I am, too. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Stephen Walt of Harvard University, the Kennedy School, more specifically, where I guess you're a professor of international relations. And we are going to try to make sense of the Middle East today. There's a lot of...
There's a lofty objective.
It really is, because it seems from afar to be in a state of near chaos, with conflict going on in lots of places. And America's policy seems not obviously coherent, some would say, since, for example, in Iraq, we are fighting implicitly on the side of Iranian-backed forces against ISIS. But on the other hand, in Yemen, we are supporting a Saudi attack on forces that are said to be allied, perhaps more loosely, with Iran. But in some sense, Iranian-supported forces that themselves are opposed to ISIS and al-Qaeda. So it doesn't make obvious sense. Some people claim that there's a method in there, but that's what we're going to talk about. For starters, do you agree with me that superficially, at least, there's a lot that doesn't make sense here and isn't reassuring?
Well, I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say it doesn't make sense. I mean, I've been pretty critical of American Middle East policy under both Republicans and Democrats in recent years. And it's certainly true that if you were looking for a simple, clear, consistent, you know, here are our friends, here are our enemies, and we're aligned with the former and opposed to the latter, then things look like a much muddier picture right now. But I think that's a reflection of just how muddy the local politics are. There are a couple things. You know, there's the old line that countries don't have permanent friends, they have permanent interests. And one could try to rationalize some of the confusion by saying the United States is pursuing a set of interests which at certain places and at certain times are leading us to cooperate, at least tacitly, with countries like Iran. And in other places and in other instances, we find ourselves at least tacitly aligned against them, because in both cases, we're pursuing what we think our interests are, and we're not necessarily completely sensitive to just the identity of who's doing what. More generally, I think you could argue that the Obama administration has had one sort of cardinal principle throughout, which is that it's going to try to minimize American military involvement. It's going to try to minimize the degree of overt social engineering it tries to do. Every time it's tried to do a little of that, it hasn't gone particularly well. It's willing to pursue diplomacy in a number of areas and at times quite energetically, vis-a-vis Israel and Palestine, and most recently, obviously, with Iran. But it's stepping back from sort of the active effort to either control the region, transform the region, or pick winners in a number of the various disputes that are currently roiling the region. And that reflects a general sense of two things. One, the Americans, the ultimate American interest is just to make sure that no hostile powers or tightly aligned set of hostile powers is controlling the region. We want it to remain divided and independent. And second, a recognition that we're really not very good at dictating the internal politics there, and therefore we shouldn't try. We're as likely to make things worse as to make things better, and in either case, it costs us something. So I think there is essentially a certain common thread to what the United States is trying to do, even if it looks a little bit incoherent. That was a fairly long-winded answer.
No, actually, it was pretty concise, as answers by academics go. But the very beginning of it, I think we lost due to bandwidth congestion. You said there's an old saying that. Do you remember what the old saying was?
Yeah, the old saying that countries don't have permanent friends; they just have permanent interests, and that the common theme, what appears to be inconsistent behavior, and that. You know, in some places we're allied with Iran, and in other places we're not allied with Iran, we're at least tacitly cooperating with Iran, and in other places we're tacitly cooperating against Iran, just reflects that in different places and at different times we're pursuing different interests.
Yeah. Now, there is a a particular worldview known as realism, with which you're associated. And it has been said not long ago by Ross Douthat, in fact, in the New York Times, that if you view Obama's policy as realist, and more specifically as an example of what realists call offshore balancing, then it kind of makes sense that he seems to be on the same page as the Iranians in Iraq, but not in Yemen, and various other seeming contradictions may make sense. Now, can you, for starters, just tell us what is offshore balancing?
Offshore balancing is basically a concept of American grand strategy. It's not actually all that dissimilar to, say, the way people used to characterize British grand strategy in the 19th century. That the United States is primarily interested in maintaining balances of power in key areas of the world. That doesn't mean the United States has to come in and control those areas directly. That doesn't mean the United States needs to come in and topple governments and try to install people we like. We just want to make sure that no hostile power dominates any of these areas that we've decided are important. Traditionally, you could argue that, you know, Eurasia, both Western Europe was one of those areas. The industrialized parts of Asia were part of that. And so the United States allied with various countries there to prevent them from being dominated by any single actor. Similarly, the United States in the Middle East from 1945 to roughly 1990 followed an offshore balancing strategy. We had allies in the region. We wanted to keep the Soviet Union from controlling the place. We didn't want any single power to control all that oil. But we didn't keep a lot of troops there ourselves. We didn't have large air force or naval deployments. We simply relied on alliances, and we shifted sides at various points, depending on who we thought was the most dangerous at any given point in time. And that strategy actually worked pretty well up through 1990.
So in this, in the current context, the idea would be that, yes, you know, Iran is useful in some contexts. It's a real priority to get ISIS out of Iraq, for example, and maybe they can be helpful. But we don't want Iran to get too strong, too dominant, and that's why we are throwing a little of our weight against them, in theory, in Yemen. I mean, that would be the theory. That was the argument, I think, that Ross Douthat was kind of making. I'm skeptical that that's really what's motivating our policy for a couple of reasons, okay? One is that you could really, I think, raise serious questions as to whether there is as close a connection between Iran and the Houthis in Yemen, that is, the people that the Shia that the Saudis are fighting and bombing, as has been alleged by people like the Saudis. So I'm not sure that the national security types in the Obama administration would be convinced that there really is this monolithic kind of threat emanating from Iran that urgently needs to be counteracted. Secondly, just the way we wound up kind of in bed with the Saudis on this has, to me, a little more of the earmarks of a reflex, almost. And there's also the alternative, the supplementary explanation, possibly, that the Saudis were really annoyed by this deal that we're trying to do with Iran, and so we figured, you know, let's do something that they would like, or, you know, what Do you really think the offshore balancing explanation in light of all that applies in this particular case?
Well, I agree with your first point that the connection between Iran and the Houthis is a relatively weak one, fairly tenuous. It's not, I think, evidence of some well-developed Iranian strategy for sort of sending its tentacles throughout the region, and the level of effort has been pretty modest. But I think you can still see what we're doing as consistent with an offshore balancing approach. I mean, the key to offshore balancing is essentially one of passing the buck. You try to get local actors who have a lot more at stake to do most of the work to uphold the balance. You don't try to contain Iran directly. You try to get other countries to contain Iran. Back in the 1980s, you'll remember the United States tilted towards Saddam Hussein and Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War because we didn't want Iran to dominate. We didn't send our troops there. We didn't send our air force. We were content, essentially, to pass the buck to Saddam. And similarly, we don't really like what's happening in Yemen right now, but it's better for the United States to let Saudi Arabia try and deal with that than for the United States to try and come in, separate the warring parties, figure out who should be running Yemen, and try to resolve the situation that way. So consistent with a sort of remain offshore over the horizon and only intervene when you really have to, letting the Saudis take care of this one or try to take care of this one, I think is completely consistent with that basic approach.
Okay, but now we move to the question of whether it's enlightened to do that in this context. In the old days, the chessboard really, it was nation states that were players, and that was kind of the end of the story. Now, today, supposedly, our big national security threat in the Middle East are these non-state actors. Well, ISIS is kind of a marginal case because they claim they're a state. But anyway, you know what I mean. I mean, the ISIS presence in Yemen is a non-state actor. Al-Qaeda is in Yemen. The Houthis, whom were kind of helping the Saudis bomb, are against ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And in fact, there was a story in the New York Times today, a good story on Yemen generally, I thought, that talked about how some important Al-Qaeda leader was freed as a result of something that the Saudis did. But so there's this complication that really, by our own account, containing some nation state in the Middle East is really not our priority. Supposedly, our big obsession is the war on terror, and it's far from obvious how this is helping us there. Not just because the Houthis profess to be fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS, because after all, you could argue that about some other players in Yemen, but also because it just seems like, shouldn't the goal be to just stay out of this? You just don't want to nourish the America against Islam narrative, which you're kind of nourishing whenever you get involved in there, almost inevitably, right?
I think we're agreeing on this one. I mean, the United States, ever since 9/11, was getting more and more deeply involved in trying to manipulate the internal politics in Yemen. We had counterterrorism operations going. There we allied ourselves with the former head, Saleh, who, it was a longtime survivor in Yemeni politics, who threw his lot in with us, or at least pretended to, for a while to get American counterterrorist support. And now we see, almost 15 years later, that whole thing has come completely unglued. I think that, first of all, it demonstrates something we've seen in some other contexts. We're just not very good at manipulating the internal politics of any of these countries, particularly given our lack of knowledge and the deep divisions within them. And therefore, trying to sort of play some combination of traffic cop, referee, judge and jury, and peacemaker in all these places is just not something we're very good at.
Right.
Secondly, the more we try to do it, the more local resistance we're likely to generate. The more groups of societies are going to turn around and say, the United States is here interfering again, maybe we should pay them back in some fashion. But I think even if your concern is the rather modest threat we face from terrorism generated from this part of the world, and I think the threat is actually relatively modest, we're better off letting local actors try to deal with it than trying to take that burden on ourselves, which again is consistent with a sort of offshore balancing approach. It recognizes that we're not going to be able to control the region, and the good news is we don't have to control it. We just want to make sure it isn't under the control of some single hostile unified power. And that's a pretty easy objective to achieve.
Yeah. So you're emphasizing the fact that at least we're not getting involved any more deeply in Yemen. You're not so much embracing the Obama administration's support of Saudi Arabia as emphasizing the lack of actual involvement, direct involvement.
Right, and we're also not in a position to tell Saudi Arabia to do nothing.
Right.
This is the country right next door. They have extensive prior involvement there. You can understand why they take the concern seriously. And so for it would have to have a very, very good reason for going to Riyadh and saying, no, we don't want you to do anything. And if that were the case, we would have to have a very good alternative policy to suggest to them, and we don't. So under those circumstances, I think it makes sense to say to Riyadh, you know, if you are really concerned by this, you know, good luck. We hope you can succeed in stabilizing things there. And, you know, we're not going to oppose your efforts at trying.
So far, there's a case being made that what they're doing is further destabilizing things. I'd say, does it look to you like this could become Saudi Arabia's Vietnam, Yemen?
I think that Vietnam is a very long and very costly struggle. It could, but we have a long way to go for that. And the Saudis have various ways that if things aren't well, they pull back and disengage more quickly. Mm-hmm. I think the kingdom will be really reluctant to get into a multi-year, extensive, you know, ground force kind of fight, such as we waged in Vietnam or such as Egypt waged unsuccessfully in Yemen way back in the 1960s.
Okay. Now, if we move to Iraq, I think last time you were on, we both thought that there was a little too much hysteria about ISIS. I believe we said, look, there's no way they're going to take Baghdad, as some people are worrying, and I think that's been borne out. And I guess implicit there was a skepticism about how deeply the administration should get involved in fighting ISIS, and certainly skepticism about, you know, framing it as a kind of war that we're in forever. How do you think things have worked out since then? I mean, apparently, Tikrit has pretty much fallen to, you know, the Iraqi government, Shia militias, with important, apparently, U.S. air support. How do you think things are going there? In Iraq broadly, I mean.
Well, I think the situation in Iraq as a whole remains deeply worrisome in that they don't seem to be able to put together a political formula that really is genuinely inclusive and brings the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds sort of back together in, if not, you know, friendship and harmony, at least effective cooperation. So I'm still not wildly optimistic about Iraq over the short to medium term. That said, I think the campaign against ISIS or the Islamic State has gone a little better than I thought. And it certainly, you know, reinforced the idea that this was not a movement that was about to take over the country or spread wildly throughout the Middle East. So in that sense, I guess I'm cautiously pleased. I am also mindful of the fact that there's still lots of sort of unintended consequences here. You know, there's a New York Times story today reporting that even around Tikrit, they made things worse. So if Americans think that we're going to be rewarded with lots of gratitude on the part of the locals for helping them, I think that's overly optimistic. You know, ultimately, I think Obama felt he had to take some steps. He clearly didn't want to be heading back into Iraq. I think he felt he had to do something to try and help the Baghdad government, but he wanted to do as little as possible because he understood that the long-term solution here has to be provided by local actors, not by external powers. And the more the United States does, the less local actors are likely to do to reform their own institutions and to deal with the problem that ISIS poses.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think of this kind of tension involving Iran in Iraq? So in Tikrit, it wasn't clear why America initially wasn't giving them air support, to me, you know, whether it's because we really didn't want to or they hadn't asked. You're getting conflicting reports. Finally, when they started running into trouble, the ground troops started running into trouble in taking Tikrit, America did intervene by air, give them support. One story was we insisted that the more directly Iranian-backed troops kind of distance themselves from the operation before we were going to really intervene. I never got a clear idea of what had actually happened. What do you think the story is with the kind of political diciness of getting, you know, being seen as allied with Iran?
Well, I think the big picture here is that the United States is going to have limited influence in Iraq going forward. Right? We couldn't control Iraqi politics back when we had 150,000 troops there, and it was really very close to the top of our geopolitical agenda. Now we have far fewer troops there. It's fallen down in terms of its place in the hierarchy of things we worry about, and therefore we're not going to be able to tell the best. Government what to do and expect it to follow orders or anything like that. By the same, Iran has some influence there. It's right next door. There are longstanding connections. There is some affinity among the Shia there, although I think that is often overstated. What we can do is provide something of an alternative. And by we, I think not just the United States, but other countries, including Saudi Arabia and some European countries, can provide Baghdad with alternative sources of advice, backing, and support so that they don't become more dependent on Iran than we would like it to be. That, again, suggests a pretty limited role for the United States, and some of that's going to be contingent on what happens to U.S.-Iranian relations as well. But the idea that the Washington, D.C. is going to shape the internal politics of Iraq at this point, I think, is fanciful. At best, we might be able to provide some useful advice, and occasionally they may listen to it, and that's about it.
So you think we made an overly big deal of the degree of Iranian involvement in this particular operation, and we should just accept the fact, look, we're de facto allies here. In the end, we can't control it. There are natural limits on how much influence they will, as a practical matter, gain in Iraq. And let's just, if we want to get rid of ISIS, let's get rid of ISIS and then move on. Is that the way you...
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, certainly there was nothing wrong with being tacitly aligned with Iran in this case, because this was one of those places where our interests were, in fact, compatible.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't clear to me whether we really were insisting they distance themselves or whether they were doing that on their own out of resentment of our involvement, and we were making the best public relations-wise out of that situation, because of course we have a lot of people here at home who oppose an Iranian nuclear deal and are also skeptical of our implicit alliance with Iran and so on. So I don't know what was actually going on there, but I think I take your point. Now, what about you do sound like you actually are a little concerned about the possibility of Iranian influence reaching some point that would be a problem from our point of view. What would that look like? Is that a real concern?
Well, I think if you step back and look at the region as a whole, Iran has the greatest potential, overall power potential, of any of the countries in that part of the world. It's got a much larger population. Its economy, even under the various sanctions that have been put on it, is substantially larger than most of the other states in the Persian Gulf region. It's got fairly sophisticated industry, fairly good universities, things like that, and at least as open a society as some of the other countries in that part of the world. So, just left to its own devices and sort of removed from the penalty box that it's been in for the last 10 or 20 years, Iran has a lot of power potential. We saw that, by the way, back under the Shah of Iran, who tended to have disproportionate weight in that part of the world. He also had a good relationship with us and a reasonably good relationship with Saudi Arabia. So you can imagine...
And with Israel, right?
That's correct. So you can imagine a world where Iran is not, I think, a potential hegemon in the Middle East. I don't think they have that kind of potential. But where they would exert a great deal of weight. And that, if tilting more heavily towards some other countries like the Saudis, certainly Egypt, certainly Israel. We're a long way from, I think, a position where Iran is threatening to dominate the region. And if the United States has a sort of long-term objective, is A, we'd like a relatively even balance of power in the region, and we'd like some effort made to resolve the various conflicts among different countries there, so there's less likelihood of a situation where we might have to intervene more directly.
Okay. So, about this Iran deal. First of all, it is as we tape this on Friday. It was announced yesterday. There's apparently a lot of it that isn't supposed to be public, but also apparently the U.S. chose to summarize pretty much all of that and release it, which Iran wasn't entirely pleased about. But it sounds like we have a reasonably reliable view of the contours of the deal. It's technically not an agreement yet. It's parameters that both sides have agreed will guide the talks as they approach this late June climax, this deadline for an actual deal. But it's pretty specific. What did you think of it?
I thought on the nuclear terms, it looked pretty reasonable. And given where we are today, accomplishes most of what the United States could realistically expect. And it's certainly better than the alternatives, which are either an unconstrained Iranian program, where they're basically free to do whatever they want with or without inspectors watching, or some kind of military action designed to delay the program. This, I think, accomplishes what has been the central American objective and then opens the door to the possibility that Iran might agree to, further reductions down the road. I think that, assumes a shift in political relations that may or may not take place anytime soon. But in terms of accomplishing the basic objective, I think it was actually quite a successful negotiation. And, I guess I should say better than I expected. I would add one other point there is I don't think we're at the finish line yet.
Yeah.
It's still possible that opponents in the United States or in Iran will succeed in derailing things. And we obviously have to make sure that the agreement is implemented in the way it's written up. But I think it was very much a step forward.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the opposition to it, as you said, Saudi Arabia is skeptical of the deal, apparently. Although I think the king actually made mildly approving noises about it. Israel is quite vividly opposed. And in America, so-called pro-Israel forces are kind of agitating against it. It seems to me that if you were really concerned about Iran getting nuclear weapons in the next 5 or 10 years, if you really saw this as the urgent threat, it would be hard to oppose this deal. Because if you look at the alternatives, most people agree that if you actually bomb them, that just ensures that in the long run they will choose to get a bomb and will get one. So what do you think is the motivation of the various players who oppose the deal?
Yeah, I've thought a little bit about this in the last couple of days, and I think actually the nuclear weapons issue itself has really been a secondary issue all along. As you suggested, if your primary concern was an active Iranian nuclear weapon, that they would actually cross that threshold, then this deal looks pretty good. You've kicked that problem down the road for 5 or 10 years, and you've certainly guaranteed that if they were to try, we would know about it long before they would actually have any kind of meaningful capability. I think even a good case can be made that it's not in Iran's interest to cross the nuclear threshold and actually weaponize, and that the Iranians understand that, precisely because if they do that, that might trigger others in the region to follow suit. And as I was saying a while back, Iran has more conventional power potential than any of the countries in the region. They're likely to be able to exert more influence in a mostly non-nuclear Persian Gulf, Middle East, than one where lots of other countries have nuclear weapons themselves. If I were Iran, I could easily understand wanting to have the latent capacity to get a bomb if I absolutely positively felt I had to at some point in the future, but not doing anything to pursue that option anytime soon. I think what's really agitating the opposition here in the United States and in the region is, again, this possibility that this is step one for getting Iran out of the penalty box. That what really this means is it removes the principal thorn in U.S.-Iranian relations and that over the next 5 years or so, you're going to see a gradual thaw. We're not necessarily going to become the best of friends, but we might reestablish diplomatic relations. We might be able to talk to the Iranians on a relatively regular basis. More Iranians coming out to study in the West and travel. More Americans going there. That we start to have something of a normal, constructive relationship. Again, not necessarily a warm friendship, but at least a business-like one. And from the Saudi perspective, from the Israeli perspective, this is not good news because they would rather keep Iranians isolated from the West, keep the United States tightly linked to Saudi Arabia and Israel, and not having really other diplomatic options in the region. I think from an American perspective, we want to have good relations with as many different countries in that part of the world as possible, in part because that's consistent with an offshore balancing strategy where you might have to tilt in various ways, but also the more relations you have with others, the more they start to compete to win America's support and win America's favor. And so if you put Iran back in the mix, where it's one of the countries we deal with, one of the countries we cooperate with, one of the countries we talk to, some of our other friends in the region have to pay a little bit more attention to keeping the United States happy. From an American perspective, I think that'd be a good thing. And I think that that's ultimately what's driving a lot of the opposition you see here in the United States. It's not the nuclear question per se. It's the possibility that Iran would rejoin the international community, re-engage economically, and cease to be the pariah state that it really has been for the last 20 or 30 years.
And can't you imagine a case where Iran's rejoining the international community and improving its relations with the U.S. in particular actually led to greater stability in the region in a way that benefited all these people, including the ones who are opposing the nuclear deal?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility, but it's not a certainty, and it depends a lot on, you know, what happens inside Iran, sort of political developments there. It depends on whether or not bringing Iran out of the penalty box reduces their own sets of security concerns. I think it does. This is a civilization or a culture, but also a regime that's been very sensitive about status issues, very sensitive about how it's treated and talked about by others. So some of this would involve sort of dealing with some of their sensitivities in a sensitive way. So I can see lots of ways in which the happy story you were painting doesn't work. But I certainly think that's something worth trying, and it's not that there's no absolute barrier to having a better relationship with Iran and then allowing that to help produce more stable relations throughout the region.
Yeah. And I mean, it does seem to me that although Iran's kind of behavior in the region has not been part of this nuclear discussion as some people hoped it would be. Some people said we should make it a precondition for talks that they clean up their act in various ways. That hasn't happened, but it does seem to me that if a nuclear deal does lead in the general direction, however slowly, toward rapprochement with the U.S., for that to get all that far, Iran is going to have to moderate some of its behavior, particularly with respect to, you know, Hezbollah and the parties that most bother Israel.
Right. Well, and there have been a number of moments in the past, particularly back in 2003, where Iran appeared to put that on the table. Right? This famous message that they sent to the Bush administration through the Swiss government, suggesting they wanted a wide-ranging discussion about their nuclear program. And it also included the sort of full range of issues. So there have been moments in the past where Iran at least sounded like they were willing to talk about a broader range of issues involving regional security. You know, a lot of this depends on what you think Iran's motivation has been. One view is, you know, that this is just a reflection of a revolutionary power that is eager to destabilize the entire region and spread its influence. And if you have that view, then sort of nothing we do is going to change things. The alternative view, which I think is more accurate, is that Iran has reacted to American and Western efforts to isolate it by building ties with sympathetic groups in other parts of the Middle East and by sort of constantly reminding everyone that they have some capability, they have some influence, they're not going to be ignored, they can cause trouble if they need to. The question that we're now going to explore over the next few years is, if you start paying attention to Iran, you start showing a reasonable respect for some of their interests, which doesn't mean you simply give them everything they want, but an acknowledgement of some of their interests, does that lead them, of course, to then pull back on the things they've done that affect us and bother our interests as well? I think that's what we're going to explore over the next few years. Both countries would obviously be better off if we can resolve some of these differences, but it remains to be seen if that's going to be possible.
Yeah. I do think a lot of it depends on, whether you view Iran as an implacably evil or as a more or less rational actor, which you tend to do, partly by virtue of your realist orientation, maybe, but also partly based on actual evidence.
I like to think so.
It all makes me wonder. I mean, given how kind of plausible it is that rapprochement with Iran could actually wind up helping Israel in the long run, and given the fact that pretty much nobody in the Israeli national security establishment actually thinks that Iran would launch a nuclear strike against Israel, and the fact that this deal seems like a pretty good way to keep them from getting a nuclear weapon in any event, one thing I wonder is whether not Netanyahu really buys into the Iran as implacable evil scenario, or whether so many Israelis do that it's just good politics for him to go berserk over this thing. And I genuinely don't know the answer. I guess I'm inclined to think it's not mainly politics with him. He's really freaked out, but I don't really know.
Well, I do think that, it's been a longstanding Israeli policy that they did not want other countries anywhere nearby to have a nuclear weapon or even a near nuclear weapons capability, that they regarded their own nuclear weapons arsenal as a sort of ultimate guarantee, and that guarantee worked better if they were the only ones who had it. So there is a sort of strategic principle behind Israel's dislike of any of its neighbors going down the nuclear road. I don't find that at all surprising. If I were the Israelis, I wouldn't want Syria or Jordan or Saudi Arabia or Iran or anybody else nearby to have nuclear weapons, and I'd like to have a few of my own. That said, this deal caps off Iran's nuclear capability for quite some time. And then I think the interesting issue for Israel is, how does this play into what I would regard as the much more serious problem, which is trying to reach some kind of deal with the Palestinians?
Okay, final question. Is about American domestic politics. You might have imagined after the Iraq War, when the neoconservative campaign to invade Iraq worked out so badly, that the Republican Party might start to see its realist side surface again, and the neocons would lose ground. But it seems to me that now, if you look at what various presidential candidates say about various things, certainly including the Iran deal, that the neoconservatives pretty much have a complete grip on Republican foreign policy. So I guess two questions. Is that overstating the case? And if it's not, do you have an explanation as to why this is?
Well, it might be overstating it a little bit, but only a little. I mean, there are still some prominent Republicans. I would think of Richard Haass, say, from the Council on Foreign Relations, who isn't in the neocon camp. But certainly it is remarkable how the neoconservatives within the Republican Party have retained influence despite the extraordinary track record. And I mean extraordinarily negative track record. If you look at the set of people that are advising Jeb Bush, they are some of the architects of some of the worst foreign policy disasters in the history of the Republic. And the fact that that any politician would want them on their masthead is kind of remarkable. I think there's a bunch of things going on here. I mean, some of it is the pursuit of money, and there's some well-heeled donors out there who have very powerful neoconservative views, whether it's, Sheldon Adelson or Paul Singer or some others. And, in American politics, you go where the money is. I think we'll eventually see some of that happen even with the Democratic side once that gets going in the campaign. Second, I think, you know, there is a sort of apprenticeship problem here that neoconservatives had a lot of impact on Republican ranks and who got jobs and who got internships and who got junior positions in the Bush administration and who has now risen up in various think tanks. And in a sense, if you wanted to go out now and recruit a 35-year-old Republican realist, you'd have trouble finding them because those aren't the kind of people that the party had been nurturing and backing and supporting. Instead, you've got 30 to 50-somethings who were all recruited, you know, in the sort of Bill Kristol days of the Republican Party, and that's the bench you now have to draw upon. And then finally, you know, we're in the primary season, and characteristically, primaries, you play to your base, you play to the extremists, you play to the people who will show up even if it's a snowy day in New Hampshire or Iowa or whatever, and then you try to steer back to a more sensible position once you've got the nomination. And the predominance of neoconservatives now may reflect a little bit of the, you know, attempt to appeal to the base at the moment, but may not reflect the actual composition of some future Republican administration, although I can't rule it out.
Yeah. Okay, well then we'll just wait for everyone to return to their senses and everything will turn out fine.
That's right. I hope you're a patient person.
Yeah, I try to be. I doubt I'll be patient enough for everything to... for coherence to ultimately prevail in the world, but in my lifetime. But thank you for trying to make sense of it, Steve. I do think it makes a little more sense than it did before I started talking to you.
I'm glad I helped.
Yeah, okay, and I hope we'll see you again down the road.
Very good. Nice talking with you, as always.
Same here. Bye-bye.